Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community.
So what's it been like so far?
Been kind of off a slow start. I mean, everything got going last week drag-wise, but we didn't find much in a lot of the fields. One field had 8 nests.
Mm.
One field had 1 nest, and all the other fields we searched had nada.
Gotcha.
Early season.
Still pretty early.
Yep.
What about all the wood duck stuff?
They're kicking off pretty good. I've heard a couple broods on the water already, which is early. So you kind of, you know, with all nesting, it's like a bell-shaped curve, you know. So it kind of starts pretty slow, kind of peaks into April, May, and then kind of tapers off again. So we got kind of those early nesters going right now. And okay. A lot of nests. I checked the box at my house yesterday, and there was like 18 eggs in one of the boxes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's definitely full-blown starting nesting season.
That's awesome. Do you guys see any, like, trends from year to year of, like, how early it starts and late it starts with potential global warming and all that stuff?
Well, I don't know about global warming, but just local weather conditions, you know, play a big part. It seems like those warmer days, longer days kind of kick off, and that kind of initiates the nesting. So, like some years, like this year, we had kind of some later storms, you know, that come through and flooded quite a bit and kind of some cooler weather. And I think that kind of delays them a little bit. And then it kind of kicks off once the weather gets nice. But a lot of it, you know, with the wood ducks, mostly wood ducks, used to be with the mallards, but maybe not so much anymore. But it really tracks with weather, right? You have good wet years, you're going to have good production usually in the wood duck boxes. And you know, maybe the wood ducks aren't as susceptible to, you know, the big summer ponds like the mallards are, you know, as long as like the small creeks and rivers and small ponds have water, you know, that's where the wood ducks thrive, you know, where the mallards kind of need bigger water, more right. habitat. So
makes sense.
Yeah, well, with mallards, it seems like the rice planting really kicks them off.
So that makes sense.
You're dragging right now and you'll have a couple little hot spots. You'll get a field with, you know, 6-8 nests here and there, and then you'll have redragging great looking fields and find nothing. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, that week or two, you start driving around like, oh, everybody's planting rice. And then that next week you go drag a field and boom, there they are.
Yeah. I mean, like for the rice fields that I've seen, most of them, like they're just now getting
just starting to work.
Yeah. Chiseled and dust and stuff. So, welcome back to Save It for the Blind podcast. We have two special guests, our waterfowl biologists, Brian Huber and Jason Kosovich, who've been on the show multiple times here with Carson Odegaard. We're going to be talking about postseason pintail banding, wood duck program, anoraic salvage stuff, and all stuff waterfowl. So thank you guys so much for coming. So why don't you guys kind of brief us on how the postseason pintail banding went?
Postseason was pretty difficult this year. Like we just mentioned, the weather was kind of, we had a lot of bad weather, you know, rain, wind, floods. We had road closed. Some of our spots that we traditionally trap in were flooded out. So overall, it was pretty difficult, especially, you know, we didn't have a contract with the state to target pintails. So we kind of were open to catching more birds just whenever we got them under the net. So that made it a little bit easier. But we still wanted to target pintail because we believe that data stream is important to keep alive and to keep, you know, that data coming. So I think we caught, almost 400 pintail?
Yeah, I got the numbers right here. Yeah. We caught 6 green-winged teal, 236 widgeon, 71 snow geese, 132 mallards, and 398 pintail. And then we put transmitters on, 2 euros, 2 pintail, and 8 mallards.
Nice. Now, what's going on with the snows? Is that something new?
That was like a bonus. We pulled up in the afternoon to check the net, and there was just a grind of snows in one of the fields that we had our net in, and they were kind of like, they looked like they landed in the field, and then they were feeding, you know, eating the grass up on the road, and they'd kind of found our bait in between there, so they were kind of moving through the field, hitting our bait, and then hopping up onto the road, so we just kind of timed a shot to get a bunch of them under the net.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was kind of just a bonus.
You guys already had the bands?
Yeah, we have snow goose bands, and we've got...
Just in case?
Yeah, we pretty much... I mean, we've got bands for owls, you know, to all the way up to Canada geese, basically. So we're prepared for anything. We sometimes band owls in wood duck boxes. So
oh, okay.
We have some owl bands. But when we do the banding stuff, I mean, we pretty much try and have every band size that we can, you know, just to, if we catch it, we want to put a band on it.
Yeah. So. And you mentioned most years we have a contract. Who's the contract with and what are they trying to do with those grants?
So every year we put in for California state duck stamp funds. So that's funds from your state duck stamp goes into a pool and that money is used then for like projects, you know, like our postseason banding. For the last 15 years, we had a contract with the state. So we'd submit for that grant. We usually were awarded with that grant. The current data for the pintail model is not using that data. And so they've decided, which is fair to them, since we're not currently using the data, that it's not worth it to fund it, right? Which makes sense from their end. But a lot of the new data that people are doing new studies on, kind of like with this two-season banding. So we have, you know, you have two-season banding. So most people band preseason, right? So you get an idea of what's happening during the hunting season. Mm-hmm. Well, the postseason banding gives you a look into what's happening during the breeding season, which is extremely important too. So a lot of the new research and stuff is using this two-season banding, and so we feel it's important to keep it going without the contract. We did partner with, we wrote a grant through Sitka, and Sitka did fund us some money for it too, so we had some funds, you know, okay, supported this postseason with Sitka. So they've been a great organization working with us over the years and contributing to, you know, conservation programs like this.
And they've done some telemetry as with like funding as well, right?
Yeah. So 3 years ago, I think we got another grant through Sitka and they purchased, we bought 40 transmitters. We bought 20 and then USGS contributed 22. So we had 40 transmitters that we put on postseason. And the idea there is a lot of the birds that are marked locally. And that was one of the years we had a lot of weather. And so we assumed that a lot of the birds from the north pushed down. So if we mark birds that time of year, we're going to get more birds moving north, you know, when it comes breeding season. And we were right on the money. I mean, almost all the birds that we caught moved north. We had one go as far up to like Alberta, Canada. Oh, wow. And I think I just looked this morning. I think we have 10 active transmitters from that still. The others oh, wow. have been lost or shot or whatever from 3 years ago. So
wow. That's pretty cool. What's the story behind the Eurasian Wigeon transmitters from this year?
I don't want to talk about it. We caught a pair of Eurasian Wigeon. Unfortunately, it seems like there's still a chance, but it feels like the female transmitter is not working.
Oh, no.
So pretty bummed about that. I mean, it is what it is. But the Drake is still in California, and he's working. So I won't say exactly where he is. But yeah, the Drake's still here. Most of the pintail on transmitters have moved north. I mean, there's some all the way up in the prairie potholes already.
Already.
Yeah, so most of them have moved north, the majority of them. Yep.
Wow. Now, out of all these years of banding pintail, like, what have we found? Like, what's some of the data saying?
We're not deep into that side of the, yeah. I mean, we're the monkeys that shoot yeah. the net, put the bands down the field, guys, and then the yeah. brainiacs go in and use crazy computer models. But
when you guys are banding birds, other people are taking that data that's in the system and
it all goes into the BBL general, you know, banding database, and then researchers can access that database, pull certain banding, you know, banding streams out of there and use that to create, you know, population models, help yeah. set bag limits. Like the previous pintail model that we were, you know, operating under that gave us the one pintail for so long. What was the most recent banding data was using? Like 2009,
I think.
Yeah. So this new model has updated banding data in it.
Gotcha.
And that allowed us, you know, part of the reason why we can get threes because they updated the newer banding data.
And I'm pretty sure that California waterfowl and California specific are the largest pintail banders in the country. Now, when you get up to Canada, they ban quite a bit up there, but for state side, you know, the United States, I mean, I think we're one of the top pintail banders. So ultimately all that, like Jason was saying, that data goes into a database. Like we're field biologists, you know, yeah. for the most part, we're not sitting there crunching statistical outcomes and all that stuff, you yeah. know, but we're providing that data for the folks in US Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, academic world, and they can use that data to, you know, ultimately help provide data for this new model that's coming out, right? I mean, a lot of that is from our work. So it's kind of neat, you know, seeing the fruits of our labor, you know, through the chain of people that, you know, do those statistics and stuff.
Do you guys ever go back and look at like some of the oddballs that you've banded, like the Euros or the hybrids, and go back and look at those a year or two later to see if they're potentially still out there in the landscape?
Every once in a while I do. I try. Yeah. I mean, I know we've banded quite a few Eurasian Wigeon. We keep saying Euro, but technically Eurasian Wigeon is what we mean when we say Euro. And there's, you know, I think we've banded, I thought it was maybe around 20, and there's maybe like seven that have been, you know, harvested.
Okay.
I kind of was looking around this morning because I was looking at some of your questions, and you know what, the oldest bird I could see that we've banded was a 22-year-old mallard.
Oh, wow.
That's impressive. Wow.
Yeah. I can't quite remember. I'm almost positive it's a drake. I mean, it'd be a miracle for a hen to live that long, but, those are kind of tricky because you assume the hunter's telling the truth, right? It might have been a band that his dad shot in a drawer and he didn't know. And so it's hard to assume like it was actually 22, but that, you know, there was a couple right around that range for mallards. So it was pretty interesting.
And it's hard to keep track of individual birds. I mean, we've banded a lot of cool ducks over the years. And then like, you know, watching the band reports to see if you could find that bird as it comes back. I mean, because they send it. It might be different now with the new BBO thing, but they used to send it as like every 2 weeks in like some obscure file that you could convert to Excel. But it's, you know, it's got, not only does it have the information you're looking for, date, where it was shot, you know, that type of stuff, how old that bird was. It's got all kinds of weird codes and latitude and longitude and all this weird stuff. So you get this really obscure, basically Excel file. And it's got, you know, during opening week of duck season, it's got 400 bands on it. You don't want to scroll through that and look and see if there's anything interesting. You just, you know, copy paste it, put it in the file and move on. So it's kind of hard to keep track and sort through and look for interesting birds.
Yeah. So now the BBL has gone to an online portal. It's unbelievable how easy it is to pull data now. So it's been a huge help. So like, For instance, like the egg salvage program, every year we put together a report for our egg salvage partners of like where their birds got shot. Mm-hmm. And now I can just go in and filter for the code for egg salvage, and it'll show me all the recaptures from that. So previously, like Jason was saying, we used to have to like copy and paste it into an Excel file and then try and extract it from there. And now I can just go on the BBL and do it, you know, within an hour and be done. So it's pretty
neat. That's nice. Are we, I don't know, cost of transmitters, I'm assuming, are going down as technology gets better, or are they staying the same? Because I know we started doing transmitters not that long ago. Now every year we're putting them on. Is the trend going to be that we're continually going to do more and more and more, potentially, if the cost goes down, and there's going to be more birds that have transmitters on them nowadays?
It's USGS is still doing a lot of transmitters with the state. But I mean, most people probably don't realize this. The transmitters come from like Lithuania.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So it's not like they're not made in the state. Yeah. They come from Lithuania, and it's quite a process to order them. And with the current situation with the tariffs and stuff, I have no idea how that's going to play out. Oh,
that's interesting. I didn't even think about that. I had no clue they came from Lithuania.
Yeah. So, you know, the transmitter data is exceptional. I mean, you get, you know, real time data of where these birds are going, but at what impact on the duck is it having, right? That's kind of the question. And there's some studies that are going on that are looking at that. So it'll be interesting kind of, you know, when that comes out. But as far as, you know, the data that you get is unbelievable. You know?
Yeah. So, how much is that worth to you guys as opposed to just a band and then a return band data? It's like,
it seems to be so
valuable.
Yeah. It's pretty, you know, like with those transmitters that Sitka got us and we put on with USGS, like I was more involved with, you know, the hunters, you know, cause my name was on the transmitter. So they'd shoot it, they'd send me an email. And so it was neat, you know, sending that back to the hunter, like, oh yeah, we banded that bird in this area and it went up 3 times and then you killed it, you know, almost in the same area that we banded it, you know? So just those little stories of the transmitters. I mean, it's just amazing the tracks that you can see and the data you can pull. I mean, pretty neat. So right now, we currently don't have any plans to put more transmitters on unless we catch some nesting hens. We mostly just kind of help right now with USGS, what they're looking for, because they're like the master holders of the transmitters, and they kind of handle the data side of it, which we keep saying we're not the data guys, right? So managing that data is just insane, you know, for each bird and how many data points they're getting. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing with the data, the transmitters, they can tell when a bird like initiated incubation. They can tell if she assume, you know, if she made it through nesting or if she didn't make it through nesting, and can track her daily movements and, you know, find the nest.
Yeah, if she has a brood or doesn't have a brood, it's
pretty, yeah,
that's pretty wild.
Yep.
Now, how often, like, are the birds trafficking back and forth between, let's say, like, back in the day, people were like, oh, wait till Klamath gets cold and get the birds here. You know, are there birds like going up to the Northeast zone and back down here throughout, like,
during
the season,
honey season?
A couple times?
I've tried to look into that with the transmitters, and I've found zero evidence of them bouncing back and forth.
But through the valley?
During this time? Right. I was just looking at one that we put on this year, and this bird went up to, like, almost up to Lake Shasta, did a huge U-turn, and then came right back. But this was after hunting season. Yeah,
still too cold. Yeah, coming back.
There, cold. She's like, it's too cold, too much snow. Nope, I'm heading back to sunny California, you know?
Yeah.
So I think this time of year, they kind of make more of those trips, you know, to kind of scout for nesting or whatever. But
yeah, I haven't seen any of that daily stuff you hear little old timers talk about. Like, oh, yeah, you see the birds get up in the morning and fly north.
They're reverse going to migration.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen any of that. Going back to Klamath. During the season, you'll see birds bounce back and forth, not daily, but like,
yeah,
that bird went up to Klamath for a couple of days and it got cold again and came back down type of thing. Yeah, yeah. But nothing like daily.
And I don't think people realize how insignificant of a trip that is for a duck, right? Like, for us, it's like, yeah, we gotta get the truck, drive 4 hours.
A duck, so what's the time span on a flight like that?
Ah, man, I had like it
2 hours.
I looked at it. What? Yeah, it's not as long as you think. And they'll mill around. Like, oh, I remember one year we tracked a bird and it went up to, like, I don't know the specifics, but generally speaking, it went up to Klamath, over into Idaho a little bit, Oregon, and then back down. I think it settled in Red Bluff all within like a day and a half.
That's wild.
Right? So it's just like, it's not that big of a trip for them.
Yeah.
Obviously, it, you know, expands energy. They have to eat more and all that. But I mean, yeah, to take a little stroll up to Klamath for a bird isn't that big of an impact on their
life. I think when we first started putting them out, I think we had a pintail. We put a transmitter on a Richville. I think it made it to Klamath in like an hour and 45 minutes or 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Straight shot. Just,
yeah. Just, yep. And it'd be long. I mean, it takes data. I forget what the settings were on that pen, but like, I think most of them are what, data points every hour.
Well, you can change it. So I don't, right. It's however they want to manipulate it.
The map, the line that was made on the map was a straight line. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. There was no following Highway 5 or what other people think they might do. It was straight.
Nope. Have you guys seen anything where it's like reports from the hunters, like when they do harvest the birds, that they're alone or if they're with a pack of other, you know, flock of other birds?
That's so there's like a really small comment section in the reporting your band, and I've never seen anybody, you know,
yeah,
say like shot out of a flock or whatever.
Like, yeah. It's been both, exiled.
Well, both I've been fortunate. I shot two and they're both alone.
You hen sprig shooter. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Training a dog. It's legal. And I felt bad on one. It was like it had been on the bird for 9 days.
Yeah.
I was like.
And they were by themselves. Is that what you're saying? Mm-hmm. They came in by themselves. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
They send a survey out. Doesn't USGS send a survey out? I'm pretty sure.
I'm not sure.
Or they used to anyways. They'd send a brief survey like, how did the body condition of the bird look?
Yeah. 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 No, you're right. Exactly. Yep. Right. And then, yeah. So I said that in both. And then you could kind of, on one of them was. Not that the body condition was poor, but it was skinny, and there's quite a bit of, you know, rubbing and stuff on it.
Yeah.
You know? But, one of them was on it for like 2 months and it was kind of all over the valley, but pretty interesting.
Yep.
Did hunters, argue with you about keeping the real one or not?
That's, yeah. I mean, some people want to keep the real one. We actually, spent the money and bought some really nice replicas.
Yep.
And so we try and encourage people, if the transmitter is still functioning, we can get it back out on a bird. So we encourage people, you know, those are, at the end of the day, they're $1,200 a piece roughly. Right. Ooh. So any of those that we can get back and get them back on a bird and get new data. But you know, there's some folks that want to keep it. And I understand that. And there's other folks that are, they don't even care about it. They're like, yeah, take it. You know? So you just get a huge, you know, difference of people. So
they got the one was a real one, but it had stopped working.
Yeah,
it was like an older version, and they literally like 3D printed another one that looked very similar to the one that,
yeah,
that one I had. But one had like I didn't obviously realize it was banded or had a backpack, so I shot it again on the water and ruined the backpack on that. And then the other one was like perfect. So yeah.
Cost him $1,200.
I know. I felt bad because I was like, "Hey, I don't know if this one's gonna work anymore." You know? But yeah, pretty nuts. But what's up with all the hybrids? Do you think there's more people are asking about hybrids and Euro, Widgeon, et cetera? It seems like all the time online, it's like, "I got this hybrid," and you're like, "Yeah, that's just a hand gadwall."
I mean, I think it's a product of the internet, right? Yeah. And social media and stuff. Like, I think hybrids have been around for a long time, but just without social media and the internet, people just, you know, talked about it, right? Or sent it to your buddies, and that's as far as it went. Well, now, you know, you post something online, it could go viral or worldwide or whatever.
Yeah.
And like the whole Duck DNA program that started.
Yeah, I was telling Jeff I want to get Dr. Phil Lebreski back on now that they have the DNA stuff coming in.
So, I mean, there's new stuff. This year I collected, just from personal hunting, I collected like 60 goose samples for him to kind of get a baseline of like the Pacific flyway geese. And luckily I got, you know, white fronts, some Ross geese and some snow. So it'll be kind of interesting for their base genetics there and stuff. And we're seeing really cool hybrids come through there, you know, and some of them, I mean, what was that one? It was a banded Northern Shoveler, Cinnamon Teal and Blue Wing Teal. And so it was like
a
three-way cross and it was banded. It was 8 years old.
They had pictures of it in the South Bay. Yeah, it was pretty wild.
And it was banded in Nevada as a botulism rescue bird.
No way.
So they caught it in the summer, had botulism. They cared for it, you know, gave it the vitamins and all that stuff, brought it back. And it probably just looked like a little shoveler, you know, because it's in its alternate plumage. It's not looking all crazy. And then banded it. a kid named Nick, I can't remember his last name, shot it. And if the band was worn, so you couldn't even read it. So he brought it to my house and we etched it, sent the genetics in and everything, and got the report back. And I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was like half shoveler and then the other half was like cinnamon blue wing teal.
That's wild. Yeah.
But that was the stuff they're learning from that DNA, is like they didn't realize even up until that point that the hybrids could hybridize
some
again.
Some of them are fertile. It's like kind of been assumed that a lot of them were infertile. And there was another gadwall mallard, you know, I got a lot of flack for it and people are like, that's not a mallard, that's not a brewer's duck. I was like, that's my opinion, you know, I can only guess from a picture. Well, you know, what do you want me to do? So we ended up sending that back in and it came back as a brewer's duck. So I was like, all right, maybe I'm on the right track.
Genetic proof.
But it was a second generation. So it wasn't.
So it kind of got bred out of it a little bit.
Well, no, the dad was a brewer's duck that hybridized with a gadwall or whatever. So it was like, it was an interesting story there too.
Huh. Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
We took DNA samples on 97 mallards this summer up in Klamath. Because Phil Lavretsky's kind of in charge of tracking that hybridization with game farm mallards.
To see if we have any farm on our side.
What do you guys see there?
What do you think?
We're up to...
I'm guessing that it's not good.
We're up to 8%.
8%?
8%.
Yeah.
Game farm genetics in our wild mallards. And what I thought was pretty cool...
What was it a few three years of them, ago? Like, does anyone know?
The last time they did it...
2%?
2%.
It was low,
Oh, geez.
Yeah. But what I thought was cool is three of the ducks that we took samples from had black duck genetics in them.
Yeah.
And How was that possible? And I guess Phil said it was
they've just backcrossed so much across the continent that there's just trace genetics of them. Yeah.
That's wild.
But yeah, potentially, how many was it? It was like three of them out of almost 100. So one out of, you know, 100 mallards you shoot might be part black duck. Yeah.
1/16th or whatever it is. But yeah, they had black duck genetics. I thought that was pretty cool.
Huh. Well, that's pretty scary about the game farm mallards.
It's definitely concerning. Yeah. Yep. So it'll be interesting. I know they expanded the duck DNA this year to more states. So I know like folks in California, you know, got some samples and stuff. So it'll be interesting what their results come out. But yeah. Yep. Yeah. We need to get Phil back on and talk about our California mallards. And
yeah, that'd be a good conversation.
Talk stop about releasing game farm mallards.
No more pure mallards in California.
Yeah. Can you guys talk about how you guys ban or trap the ducks? There's the rocket nets and then the swimming traps. What's the difference and when do you use either technique?
The rocket nets work best on flighted birds, typically. Swimming traps work when you have molting birds or young birds that are stuck in a wetland unit and they're desperate for food. That's when the swimming traps are effective. So a rocket net we use mainly for preseason and postseason pintail. And we'll do some here and there. Like we've done a wood duck shot with it. We've caught some summer mallards with it, but it's mainly for pintail. And like preseason, so September, October, putting bait out doesn't really work. Every wetland unit's fresh food and they don't really pay attention to any bait that you pour out. So we catch them on roads and islands where they're out loafing midday, preening themselves, drying off, sleeping in the sun, stuff like that. And then postseason, after all the resources are depleted, then they get on the bait pretty heavy. And you just pour some bait out along the edge of your net, along a road or something. And once they find that bait, it's pretty much game on.
So you guys basically have these big, long nets.
Yeah, they're 30. They're a rectangle, 30 by 60, I believe. 30 feet wide, 60 feet long. And we fold them up into long strips, and you can put them end to end. So you could stack as many as a 3-net set. So you could have 180 feet of net.
Ooh,
and dang. Then each net gets 3 rockets on the top side, 3 or 5 anchors on the bottom side. And then you kind of run a wire that connects all the rockets together and run that wire like 300-400 yards away to a spot where, you know, you're hidden. And then someone shows up and views the net, counts how many birds are under it, and make sure that, you know, nothing's going to get killed, anything like that. And someone's on the detonator, make a phone call, shoot it, boom, it goes off, and then it's a mad dash to go get the ducks out of the net.
You guys don't have a Wi-Fi detonator yet?
No, not yet. They make
Bluetooth signal.
Apparently, with like the power lines and stuff, that you don't want it to accidentally signal it off. So you got to be real careful using anything Wi-Fi. I like the old school. I mean, I joke, but I want one of those old TNT, you know, TNT blaster box handles. Yeah,
that'd be sweet. That'd be
pretty funny to set some nets off with one of those.
Our hunt program is still accepting applications for spring pig hunts. Visit calwaterfowl.org to apply today. We're still accepting applications for our Camp Sprig events. These events are for participants 10 to 16. So if you have a young hunter looking to obtain their hunter education certificate, these are 2.5-day camps designed to provide hands-on learning. While you're there, don't miss out on our membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for waterfowl conservation. We do have some upcoming events. Our Folsom recruitment meeting and social May 1st, and our Santa Rosa banquet on May 2nd. Thank you for the support. CalWaterfowl.org. I mean, how hard is it to find a site, have it accessible, and then have birds on it? I mean, like, do people, you know, I hear it a lot of times, hey, I want to go banding with the crew. It's like, yeah, you could contact them, but I was like, who knows if they're going to set a net, what day or when or where.
Rocket netting's tough because you never know when they're going to. You try to set the nets in the best location possible, obviously, but weather plays a big factor in it. You can't shoot it into a strong wind. If it's windy at all, typically they don't like to be pressed up against edges because it, you know, the movement of the brush and stuff scares them. And it's just so hit and miss.
Yeah.
That's why
it's tough. Yeah.
Volunteer opportunity is best for swimming traps because typically, you know, it's like a trap. It's a fish trap,
yeah,
but modified for ducks, and you're going to have something. You have, you know, 6, 8, 10 traps out every day. You're going to have something in some of the traps for some action for the kids to band or the volunteers to band. So much better for volunteers.
What about our egg salvage program? We're taking over the facility at Rancho Escalon, or have anything on the books there for people to put on the calendar or attend this year?
Yeah, let me pull up the dates here. But we got 2 general hatchery tours where the public shows up. They it's great for kids, but oftentimes the adults love it more than the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, basically you get a full tour of the hatchery. You get to learn about the egg salvage program, what's happening to our local waterfowl populations, what CWA is doing to help. You get to go through candling eggs, seeing eggs actually hatch, like ducklings crawling out of the eggs, which is pretty cool. Get to handle some ducklings, learn about their life stages. Every kid gets to band their own duckling, and then at the end of the tour, we take them out to the natural wetland habitat out there and let them go. So it's a pretty cool event. Everybody always raves about it. We got an event for that on June 22nd. That's a Sunday. And then July 19th, which is a Saturday. Those are our two events this year. We're capping it at 40 people. Last year, we only did one, and we had way too many people show up.
Do they need to sign up on our website?
They just RSVP with me.
Okay. Just
go on the website, find my contact info. You can text me, 408-644-3525. Just say, hey, my name's so-and-so. I'm bringing me and my two kids to the Hatchery Tour on the 19th, and I'll put you down. And, yeah, pretty much show up and have a good time.
And that's just right south of Chico and in Durham.
In Durham, so. Yep.
Yeah, if no one, if you have not been, it is awesome with kids and wives and family, duck hunter or not duck hunter. It's pretty special to hold a baby duck and duckling in your hand and band it. So we've done it with our 4-H group a couple times, and everyone's still got a kick out of it. So, but with the egg salvage, I mean, this time of the year, you know, we have wheat fields growing. Is this kind of your busiest time of the year, being out in the field and tracking people down and dragging nests?
It's starting to. Wheat isn't a thing yet, just because they don't harvest it until July, you know, or excuse me, beginning of June, into July. So wheat's not the issue right now. It's more cover crops is what keeping us busy. So a lot of organic farmers will plant cover crops, vetch, beans, some type of legume that puts nitrogen in the soil so they don't have to spend money on expensive organic fertilizer like chicken poop. And so they got to get rid of that cover crop in order to plant their actual cash crop. And they'll go in with a, you know, a chopper and a disc and turn all that stuff into the soil before they plant tomatoes or vine seed or whatever they're doing. So they call us beforehand and we go and sweep the cover crop fields for nests. So that's what's keeping us busy right now. And we're getting rolling on the NB hip stuff. So we just closed our application for the delayed wheat program and the fallow ag program. Scored all those fields last week, went through the selection process, picked which fields we're going to fund for that this year. And then now I'm in the process of calling landowners, notifying that they're either funded or not funded, and picking which fields we're going to monitor for that for this upcoming nesting season.
So what did you guys find last year through that program?
We monitored, I want to say, 1,300 acres. We found 60-something nests, 67 nests, only four of which hatched.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yes. But we have a predator problem.
Oh, but, so that's what it was from.
And yeah. These are all on rice checks?
No, that we found two on rice checks.
Okay.
The vast majority of them were in cover crop fields. That's part of our fallow ag program. We pay $110 an acre for cover crops to be left until July 15th, because normally they're doing what they're doing right now. You know, they just turn them into the ground and they're gone. So we pay for them to leave them. And, yeah, we had a couple of those that were top producers. We had the vast majority of our nests in there. But
wow.
What predators are the main ones?
I think mainly ravens. And then a lot of aerial predators. And then, obviously, skunks, raccoons, possums, stuff like that will get them, too.
Interesting.
But I think the main problem we had last year was aerial predators.
Wow. You wouldn't really think of that, I guess.
No.
You don't think it'd be the skunks, the raccoons, the coyotes.
I mean, we're dragging the fields, and if something's in that field, you know it. It goes running out in front of the rope, and you rarely see any kind of predators in those fields. And then you look up, and there's hawks flying around. There's always ravens, crows flying around. So I think that's got to be what's getting them.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, I guess. But what are you guys most excited about this coming year? I mean, what are you guys thinking? We've had a kind of a wetter late winter, but
man, I can't wait.
The last few weeks have been pretty hot.
I can't wait to see Lower Klamath. I mean, I heard it's almost fully flooded, if not fully flooded. The amount of production we should see from there should just be insane. I mean, last year there was basically one unit on the Lower Klamath side that had, you know, summer water, and it was plugged full of birds. So spreading those birds out, hopefully, you know, having more habitat for them, and hopefully we can do summer banding again up there and be successful.
You guys have plans for that?
Yeah, we're currently planning on heading up there. We got to hear from the manager up there, kind of get the reports, and then make our decision on where we're going to do our summer banding. But it's hard not to go up there. You know, we do the night lighting, you know, with the airboats. We do that two days a week, pretty much through the season if we can. And what we almost caught 7,000 birds last year, I think it was.
Jeez, yeah.
That's all through
with us. Wow. With the airboats, Fish and Wildlife Service,
CWA. A couple nights were over 1,000, three nights over 1,000.
I couldn't imagine what it would be like if we have the water that we have now throughout the summer.
Right.
That'd be crazy.
Yep. Yeah. So as long as we can mitigate, you know, the botulism, which with all the water, they should be able to mitigate it pretty good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that, definitely.
Anyone ever fall out of a boat yet while it's running?
That would be me.
Yeah?
You did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got ejected.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. At full speed. Well, not full speed, but moving pretty good.
That was during the day, too, right?
You're like leaning over the side?
No, we were coming back. So we were, that year was one of the good years. We had swimming traps up as well, and we were catching a lot of birds in the swimming traps. And we were coming back from checking them. And airboats are real finicky of what type of water they like to run in. So ideal for an airboat is shallow, like a couple inches. You get deeper than that and you get, you know, big wakes that can swamp the back. They have low transoms. They got to let the wind flow out the back of the boat. So they're just real finicky, like how they like to run and what. And then on top of that, we were in the small little boat that they have that is like underpowered and doesn't handle very well. But that's just what they gave us. We're just running swimming traps. No big deal. But we were coming back to the launch ramp. The launch ramp's on a ditch, right? Deep ditch. And next to the ditch is the shallow flats. And the pond was getting low. And so it was shallow. And the boat likes to slide when it's shallow, which is good for an airboat. But we hit the deep water, kind of sliding at a little bit of an angle. It wasn't bad. We made that same loop, you know, every day for the last 2 weeks. No issues. And just the way the angle we came in at, I guess the boat just couldn't get traction in that deeper water and just kept sliding sideways. And the boat's underpowered, so the only way to stop an airboat is called emergency 180. So you slam the steering rudders to one side or the other, and then you stomp on the gas, like briefly, like one big pulse of air, and that'll whip you around. And then once you're facing the opposite direction, so you're moving backwards, then you punch it, and you stop yourself by turning around and going the other way, basically. Well, that airboat's so underpowered, it wouldn't do that. And so operator tried to do a emergency 180, didn't work. We were just sliding sideways into the thing, and it was the only problem. It would have been like a nice landing, because all I did, we just hit a big wall of tules, and I just flew out of the boat and landed in the tules. I never even touched water.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the operator stayed up in his seat, but there's like a little piece of, you know, quarter inch sheet metal in the corner where the bow, where like the deck of the bow deck meets the sidewall of the boat. Yep. They put a little brace in there. Well, my calf muscle hit that going on the way out, and I thought I'd broke my leg.
Oh, gosh.
And by the time we got to the hospital, it was like a baseball-sized thing of blood in there.
Ooh.
No issues. I mean, I just, they took scans of it and everything and said, you're good to go. Just keep a compression bandage on it. And you could still see it. Like if I took my pant leg up, you could still see the dent in my calf. Yeah.
No kidding.
Yep.
Didn't you guys get certified to drive, or one of you guys?
Yeah, we're both certified to drive on federal land.
Okay.
The state gets a little trickier. It's kind of weird. We have like a federal airboat license.
Yeah.
But we have to take a course through the state to be able to do it on the state and have like special use permits and all that stuff on state land. So, I did see the state just got a bunch of new airboats.
Maybe
can go play with them this summer.
Yeah.
If they have any summer water.
What did they get them for, just for that?
Their old boats were 40 years old. Oh, they're okay. Just like really, you know, just not really even working anymore. But they need them for like if there's any kind of a cholera outbreak or botulism outbreak to pick up birds, burning. They use them quite a bit for burning some habitat, like SAC refuges, theirs for that. So, they're very useful in, you know, shallow water habitats, you know, even just maybe doing blind work, you know, to, if it's flooded, you know, to cruise out there and do
surveys.
Stuff,
so. I mean, you name it. Yeah. Anytime you want to get around on a shallow wetland efficiently, airboat's the way to go.
Right.
No other option, really.
Yep. Yeah. What's the, I know we're coming up on wood duck season. What's the status of the wood ducks? And I know we were giving away a bunch of boxes to pretty much everyone who wanted it. So,
yeah, no. So this, we just last spring, we hit our 1 millionth wood duck, hatched out of our boxes. So that was a huge milestone for the program. And that's, you know, we just kind of manage the program. It's really all the volunteers across the state that do all the work. They're checking the boxes, putting them up. So to promote, you know, the wood duck program, our goal was to give away 500 wood duck boxes. Well, those 500, the first 500 went pretty quick. So we're up to 1,000 boxes now that we've given away. Just for this spring.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's you don't have to enroll in the program, you know, like some folks don't want to enroll. That's fine. They're going to put their boxes out and manage them. But we've gained a lot of new projects through it too. So people, you know, hey, I see wood ducks at this house by my pond by my house, you know, and I want to put a wood duck box up. Perfect, you know, and so they, you know, excited about it. And I've handled so many emails, phone calls, text messages about new boxes, how to put them up. And, you know, anybody that has new boxes, you know, I encourage you to go to our website and check out the Wood Duck page. If you just Google California Wood Duck Program, it's the first thing that pops up. You can click on there. There's all kinds of links and information on, you know, putting up new boxes, mounting them, checking them. It has all my contact information there for the Wood Duck Program. Yeah, it's been a huge success. I mean, 1,000 new wood duck boxes out there on the landscape's definitely going to,
that's know, a lot help, of wood ducks.
Our local yeah, wood ducks. Awesome. Yeah. And then it's, you know, it's created a lot of new areas, like up in Humboldt area. You know, I've got some folks up there that really kind of took the bull by the reins, and they're, you know, starting a lot of projects up there. So that should be interesting to see cool. those programs. And then some people down in Southern California as well. So kind of expanding into areas, you know, non-traditional wood duck areas.
Are we going to continue doing that next year?
To be determined, but okay. I believe we're going to try and do it for 2 years and see how it goes. But it you know, we're getting a cabinet maker to build these for us. So it does cost money, right? So it wasn't free for us, you know?
Right.
I think we're going to work again and get some out next year and do the same. So we'll see. I haven't had time to sit down and hash out all those details yet, but.
Gotcha. Yep. But some boxes, I mean, we get from Boy Scouts, and we've had some wood duck building day, but obviously not 1,000. That's
a lot. Yeah. I mean, traditionally, you know, before we did the giveaway, we'd maybe go through 100, 150 boxes a year.
Oh,
and
wow.
we would sell them, you know, $40 a piece. And it just wasn't, we're not getting a lot of boxes out there. You know, a lot of people that have existing projects, you know, the boxes only last so long, right? I mean, you're out there in the elements, the heat, everything, and they just degrade over time. So a lot of the boxes went to existing projects too, you know, people that have projects and need to replace them or wanted to add more boxes.
So,
Yep.
That's cool.
But it started off the spring. It's been a good spring for nesting. I mean, there's been a lot of activity. I get a lot of people have sent me, you know, messages. Hey, I got a couple hens in the new boxes, you know, thanks. And just folks are excited. And it just seems like it's going to be with all that late spring water that we got. And I mean, everywhere, there's still puddles and stuff everywhere you look.
Yeah.
So, should be a really good year again for wood ducks. So it'll be nice to see, hopefully folks turn in their data and we can boost our numbers and, you know, see how we're doing.
How early have you seen a wood duck in a box, and how late have you also seen a wood duck in a box?
I've heard of birds. The earliest I would say is probably February.
No, jeez.
And that some, you know, hooded mergansers nest in the boxes too, and they tend to nest a little bit earlier. So February, we usually have quite a few hooded mergansers, but there's also some wood ducks in there as well. I'm sure there's probably wood duck nests that have started in January too, you know, just on the certain kind of year if the temperatures were warm or something, you know. But it kind of ebbs and flows. You have like warm periods, it seems like it kind of initiates some nesting, and then it gets like a cold spell and it kind of slows down the nesting initiation and stuff. So and then the latest, I mean, probably well, unfortunately what happens in the valley sometimes is the temperature's so hot that in some of the boxes, the eggs just die and the hen doesn't know it. Maybe it's a young hen. It's her first attempt at nesting. And so generally speaking, the older experienced hens are going to nest earlier in the season because that's when the resources are the best. The younger birds are going to nest later in the season because that's kind of when what's available and they're just trying to figure it out, right? They don't, maybe they didn't mate with a strong male or something, right? So, but we've had the eggs actually die in the nest. The female doesn't know it and she'll just be sitting on it for like way, way too long. So at that point, when we can identify that all the eggs are dead, we'll just evict the eggs and kind of kick her out of the box.
Gotcha.
And I think that probably in August is probably the latest. Yeah.
Yep. It's such a long time frame.
Yeah.
I know. What's up with the hooded mergs? Like, it seems like they're very abundant now.
Yeah, those guys in the sink need to start shooting them.
Yeah.
I mean, you need a separate merg limit like they got in Michigan.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that.
Yeah. They, for whatever reason, they've really taken off in the Butte Sink habitat area. You know, a lot of the clubs there, anywhere on Butte Creek, kind of Sac River, that whole corridor is just mostly Butte Creek, but it's exploded the population over the years. So, yeah.
But it wasn't like that like 10 years ago.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, I'm not sure
what led to
it.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it
there's a lot now.
I mean, it's their cavity nester, right?
Byproduct of our wood duck boxes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they probably generally speaking, if you're you're hatched out of a wood duck box, you're going to seek out a wood duck box instead of a natural cavity.
Okay.
So they're, that's kind of what they saw, the, what they're used to. Right. And so if they see that again, they're like, oh, this is where I make a nest to do my thing. So over time you had a few hooded mergansers figure it out. Well, now you've got this whole breeding population that are, you know, keyed in on these boxes and, gotcha. And every year they keep coming back. I mean, we've banded them for years now, and it's amazing how many same hens, you know, just like the wood ducks, come back to the same box, if not the same box, you know, within the same area.
Yeah, that was my question, is most of these hens, they're going back to the same areas or the same boxes year after year.
Yeah, right? Yep. And they're theoretically, their offspring is going to come back to the same area that they were born. So that's kind of where you get this effect of,
it's like a multiplication 10 years ago, factor.
There wasn't any hooded mergansers. Well, now there's, you know, yeah. probably thousands of them nesting in the right. sink. And so that's kind of what's neat with the wood duck program is over time, if you keep a project going, you're going to keep recruiting the birds that hatch from the previous years back to your place and establish kind of your own local population.
Mm-hmm. As far as birds, either mergansers or wood ducks, what's the furthest harvest that we've had away from a banding location for those?
I know that we had a wood duck harvested in Arkansas.
Jeez.
That was banded in our program. And I think that's one of the one that comes to the top of my mind. I haven't looked recently, but I know that there's one shot there, and that's kind of, you assume that that's the truth, right? I mean, with all this banding data, you're relying on the hunter to tell you the truth, which they don't always do, you know? So, but that's the farthest that I know of for them, but we get a lot of them, a lot of our birds will go up to like Idaho, southern Canada, and kind of that little corridor. So the Idaho actually has a pretty decent wood duck population. Same with Oregon and Washington. And so we'll get some birds that kind of go up there certain years.
Go up there during the hunting season or go up there and,
potentially
breed and then stay there and then.
Yeah, I mean, mostly hunting season, I think. But yeah, they'll be they'll usually go up there and then come back for breeding season.
I think they're smelling the corn.
Yeah, probably.
The Mergs do that for sure. Because we have to go through a lot of bands for our annual Murdoch report. We're contracted to check wood duck boxes on Murdoch Gun Club. And with that comes a report that I have to do. And so I have to go through every bird that we recapture on the property and see, you know, where it came from. And then I got to go through our banding database and find every bird that we banded on Murdoch and see where it was harvested. And a lot of the mergansers, for some reason, always end up farther north. Idaho, Washington, Oregon.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're always on like some river up there somewhere.
They go chase the fish migration.
Yeah, they'll put, because you know, a lot of times people, when you report a band, you could put a pin directly on where you're at. People will put their GPS points. And so I'll get like some obscure town in Montana or something, right? And I'll go and just copy and paste the GPS coordinates in, and it's like some random little river way up there. And that's where that hooded merganser went during duck season.
That's gotta be pretty cool though, to see and do and look at some of your guys' work. Right. I mean,
yeah, it's time consuming doing it one at a time like that. But when you do it, you find some cool ones for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any like desire to band other birds that you're not banding now in terms of waterfowl?
I mean, I've always wanted to go up and do some of the goose drives that they do up in the Arctic, you know, like the big with the helicopters and stuff when the geese are molting with like the brant or, you know, the snow geese or whatever. I think that would be kind of like a bucket list for a biologist thing, you know.
Right.
I did get to go up to Canada and band pintail with them. And that was pretty neat to experience that. One of the first years I was on full time, went up there and helped them, and just the amount of birds that you see in those units was just insane, you know. And most of them were molting. It was kind of during the summer, so it was fun. They wanted to do rocket netting up there. I was like, no, you guys need to do night lighting. Like, you guys have so many molting birds. I mean, I had a video, and we busted through this tule patch, and it's just a sea of pintail just pushing off. I mean, it was insane how many birds were up there. But they were intrigued about rocket netting, and I was, you know, excited about, you know, in the airboats and stuff. So
yeah.
Yeah.
How'd you guys catch most of them in the airboats?
Swim
in
traps.
Okay.
Yeah. So we just use the airboats to go, because the ponds are, they call them ponds, but they're more like lakes. I mean, they're huge reservoirs, shallow reservoirs, you know, and a lot of the birds were or molting in there. And so they just had swim in traps and we'd use the airboats just to get around.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You guys have both handled lots and lots and lots of waterfowl and put bands on many of them. Do you have a favorite bird that you've banded or a favorite banding memory?
I'm a sucker for the Eurasian widgeon. You know, I mean, going to college with Jay Boggiato at Chico, you know, he was like the Eurasian widgeon guy. And I've just always had a soft spot for those Eurasian. Jason gives me a hard time because he's like, man, Brian just picks those things out of nowhere and all he wants to do is catch Eurasian widgeon, you know. But I don't know. I've always loved catching them. I think they're a beautiful bird. I'm really still hoping to shoot a nice mature drake so I can mount it, but that hasn't happened yet. So.
Jason, what about you?
I don't have any. Can't think of one in particular. Not really. I mean,
that mallard pintail hybrid.
Yeah, that was a cool bird.
That was a really cool bird.
Oh, that's cool. When was that?
So 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I tried to look it up a year or two ago to see if it had been harvested, but I don't think it's been harvested yet. So that potentially might still be out there, a banded pintail mallard.
Probably my favorite memories are at night on the airboat. You see some wild stuff out there and it gets crazy. Like this past summer, I mean, like go out of the boat ramp, hang a left, you get to that first bay and it's like, oh my God.
Gadwall Bay.
Yes, yep. I mean, the whole entire bay is a giant brood. There's no like.
It's like a rodeo.
You just
out there,
idle. Yeah. You just idle in the airboat, and the catchers on front are just scooping and crating as fast as they can.
And now that
everybody's laughing and clapping, it's just a good time. And then you get back to the shore, and you're all amped up. You're banding birds as fast as you can, so you get back on the boat and go. It's good. It's a good time.
And now that we get a drive, you know, you're not getting beat up on the front.
You get beat up on the new guys and stuff.
Yeah.
I think a question people might have is like, you know, you talk about night lighting a lot. What time are you guys going out and getting done with that?
From dark, you wait till it's completely pitch black. So that time of the year, it's only like 9 o'clock, you start running. And then you go until it's just start. Like you could tell all of a sudden, like birds are easy to catch all night. And all of a sudden it's like they're running for the tulies. And you look, you know, towards the east and you could see just a little tiny glow starting. It's like it's game over.
So you guys are literally going after sunset to sunrise, working through the night.
Yeah. We're launching the boats right at sunset. We get the banding station set up and everything while it's getting dark. And then by the time we're done with all that, it's like put your life jackets on. Let's roll.
Go get breakfast, go to sleep.
Well, what did we do one year? We nightlighted all night. We ran over and shot a rocket net
twice.
Yeah,
right after
night lighting, and then we ran and checked our swimming traps.
Yeah.
So we did all three in one morning, I guess.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. That's wild.
That's when clam is good, when it's got water. It's like that.
Just chasing ducks everywhere you can.
Yeah.
Yep. Like are they in the airboat, you're like idling, you have spotlights in your hand. Are they like trying to get out of the way? Or are they just like, oh, do?
And depends. On a older bird or a full moon, they will try to actively get away from the boat. But you get a no moon and ducklings, they swim into the side of the boat. You can almost shut the boat off and just sit there with the light in the water, and they'll come swimming to the light like mosquitoes sometimes.
But you get an adult molting male gadwall in open water, and that sucker's hard to catch.
Yeah.
They dive on you, and it's like, yeah, I usually give it one. If he dives, you're just like, he's done. Yeah, done. But sometimes you can go pretty quick and get up on the side, and you're kind of racing them, you know, trying to race up and stay parallel with them so that your netter can scoop them up.
Yeah.
Seems, it's fun. You should come out with us. This
sounds like a good time.
Yeah. Can I raise my hand and be the boat driver?
Nope.
Do you guys argue over who gets to drive the boat?
No, it's turned into a long night.
Yeah.
And it gets cold up there. I mean, when it's good and you're in a good unit and it, you know, you just go out for half an hour and fill the boat, come back, it's nice. But there's also nights where you're chasing molters down and it's cold and you're doing 20 miles an hour chasing the molters down all night long. And you're like, after three crates, you're like, I am done. Yeah. Someone else take this seat, please.
Yeah.
And it depends on your catchers too, right? Because like it's not easy catching them. And so like, there's really good catchers, and you're like, oh, yeah, I want him on my boat. And then there's, like, new people that just haven't quite figured it out yet. And, like, you put them on a bird, like, four times, and they can't get it. You're like, oh, my gosh. It's, you know,
it's so like
it can be frustrating.
Picking teams at school. It's like first draft pick.
Yeah. And then everybody ranks all the drivers. You know? Like, oh, I don't want to drive with Huber. He's crazy. Or, you know.
I feel like I'd be a good netter.
A good hand-eye coordination.
Yeah, just be like.
I think I'm gonna try and get my son out there this year.
Yeah,
that's one of my goals. He's ready.
Heck yeah,
he's that's all awesome. About it. Yep,
freaking cool. Well, what's your guys' opinion on our last duck season, and what do you think the upcoming 25-26 season is going to look like? We're going to have our regulations approved here in a couple days. What are you guys thinking? How was last duck season?
I think it was a good, for me, it was a good season. And I mean, it wasn't outstanding, but I don't think there's really much to complain about. We did have that dry spell in January and the
full
weather,
moon.
Weather got stagnant, full moon came, it just perfect storm of bad duck hunting weather. Yep. And so there was like 3 weeks where it sucked there. But other than that, it was pretty good from my experience. As far as next year goes, I say it's all weather driven. It will be nice to have the 3 pintail limit. It seems like there's never a shortage of those in the rice, regardless of the weather, what the other ducks are doing.
Yeah.
There's always pintail around, so that'll be nice. But as far as everything else goes, it'd be interesting to see how much rice gets planted. That has a huge impact on our hunting up here. I know rice prices are down and we had a late winter, and we'll see what gets planted, what doesn't.
Yeah, I've heard kind of mixed reviews on that. I've heard there's not going to be a lot planted, and then there's a lot of people I've talked to that are planting that didn't plant last year, you know, so I'm not sure. It'll be interesting how that shakes
out.
It'll
probably be a lot of rice. I mean, yeah. There's some people who are going to opt out, but it's going to be similar to last year. I figure with rice prices and everything, there's going to be quite a bit of rice planted and quite a bit of rice flooded, which will not help the hunting. Drought's always better, but it should be good for our local production, and Klamath puts out so many birds, and it's fully flooded this year. So
yeah.
I'd imagine that if we get that push from Klamath, it's going to be a lot of dumb gadwall and dumb mallards too. And you guys probably saw it too, like the mallard, you know, the uptick in the mallard harvest last year.
Yeah, I think everyone saw that.
Yeah, and I don't think it's because the population was so much bigger, because I see mallards every year, but they were young ones this time, and that makes a big difference when you're hunting. You got to have young ones.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, it's going to be interesting with the rice. I mean, last year we had a lot of rain throughout the spring, and really in April so far we've had like one day of bad rain, but I'm excited. I'm really looking forward to the 3 pintail.
Yeah, hopefully that gets pushed through, and should be good. I mean, like Jason said, the production in the northeastern zone, you know, even the Altura side, you know, we get a lot of birds that go up there and nest and molt and stuff, and the conditions up there are just really good. So that we should see that in our flight next year.
Yeah. Well, appreciate you guys coming on the podcast today and talking to us about everything that you guys do, and we appreciate it. And thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having us
on.
Thanks
for having us.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks, guys. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.